5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. On this episode, we have the news, and we have Tanana Reeve Dew and Stephen Barnes talking to us about Afrofuturism and the movie Black Panther.
There's never been a cinematic spectacle like Black Panther that so firmly establishes this kind of visual mythology of power, technological prowess, courage, family, community. It's just, it's a really important nutrient for the growth of Black folks.
You know, the thing that I'm mindful of this week is that representation is important. That it's important that you can see yourself not only in the future, but in the present. It's why movies like Black Panther are important. We also need to think about the representation of resistance, the representation of family. Like, the things that we consume in the public have a big impact on the way that people think about the world. You think about the police in movies, is that you can't name an action movie that has police in it, like as characters, as central characters, where tons of people don't just die as a result of them finding the bad guy. That people's lives become just like the okay collateral consequences of what movies sort of tell us justice looks like. And we have to be mindful of those because people consume them over generations, though. Like, people's conception of justice and policing is largely influenced by shows like Cops that did real damage, or things like, you know, you look at me and Sam were talking to someone about Bad Boys. It's like hundreds of people die in that movie, you know, like are shot at or are just casualties of the police. So representation is important about race, about justice, about a future, about freedom. That's it. Let's go. And you know it's the news with me, Brittany Packnett, former member of the Ferguson Commission and appointed by President Obama to the Task Force on 21st Century Policing, and now a leader in education, Clint Smith III, our resident academic, and Samuel Sinyangwe, our resident data scientist.
It's the news. This is Brittany Packnett at Ms. Pacchetti on all social media.
And this is Sam Sinyangwe at Sam Sway on Twitter.
What's going on, y'all? This is Clint Smith at Clint Smith III.
And this is DeRay at DeRay, D-E-R-A-Y. I'm sparing you the I because we got feedback that somebody didn't like the I.
That person probably is representative of millions of people around the world who feel that their names too have been done a disservice and have been disrespected by, I don't feel disrespected, that's traumatic, but you know what I'm saying. I don't know about y'all, but I am a big Olympics fan. I'm like, whether it's the Winter Olympics, the Summer Olympics, the Olympics in your backyard, I'm here for it all. There's a lot of nostalgic value associated with it for me. Like growing up, we just always had the Olympics on like in the background. And I don't know about y'all, but it's one of those things where like, I think we talked about this before in the context of the World Cup, where like Black folks who sometimes like don't regularly watch these sports become very invested in certain sports when they see Black people doing them. So like, you know, I have these memories of like my grandpa being like very invested in like short track speed skating. And this man doesn't know anything about short track speed skating, but he saw, what's his name? Shawnee. I don't know his last name, but like this, the Black guy who's been on the Olympic speed skating team for the last couple rounds. And he's just like out here talking about Shawnee, like they went to school together. And like, that's his grandson. I'm like, I'm your grandson. What are you talking about?
Now the news.
some news that might have been overlooked by folks this week, but that has really huge implications, is that the U.S. Census Bureau announced that it is going to keep for the 2020 census, it is going to keep the practice going that prisoners are counted as residents of the place in which they are incarcerated rather than their home addresses. And this is really harmful in a lot of ways. And it also is kind of hypocritical on behalf of the U.S. Census Bureau, because it you know, you have folks who are in boarding school who are still counted at their home residence where their parents live. But you have people who are incarcerated who are counted, you know, where they are imprisoned in the correctional centers, even though oftentimes these people are spending less time in the prison than folks are at the boarding school, if you want to talk about how much time somebody spends per year. And so just to back up a little bit for some background, in 44 states, prisoners, you know, quote unquote, live in their prisons. But for the purpose of the census, they cannot vote, right? So they are bodies who are counted in these districts, but they do not have any electoral power. And these are folks who are disproportionately people of color, who are disproportionately coming from the city, both of which are places and demographics that tend to lean Democratic. And so these are folks who would be voting most likely for Democratic candidates, who are now being taken from having their bodies, you know, per the census, taken from the cities and put into these rural districts. And thus it gives these rural districts that have smaller populations, larger populations, and more potential representation without the people who are making the district more populated having any electoral power. What makes this particularly egregious is the fact that the Bureau asked for public comment on its residence rules 2 years ago, and over 99% of the nearly 78,000 comments regarding residence rules for incarcerated people urged the Bureau to count incarcerated people at their home addresses, which is almost always their legal address. But the Bureau ignored the fact that 99% of people who were asked about this issue said that it makes the most sense for our democracy to have these people counted for the home address where they live. And so they're almost picking favorites, right? They're like picking favorites based on economic and racial privileges. And, you know, for example, the Prison Policy Initiative has done this thorough report, and they talk about how the majority of people incarcerated in Rhode Island, for example, spend less than 100 days in the state's correctional centers. But if the same people were instead spending 100 days in their summer residence or in their boarding school or in their vacation home, the Bureau would count them at their regular home address rather than this other address, right? So there's a lot of sort of inconsistency with regard to how this policy is manifested and who has the opportunity to have themselves counted at their legal home address, and who the U.S. Census Bureau makes a decision about, like, where they technically live or don't live. And this is something that's really important, and obviously something that has implications in terms of giving certain places more electoral power, giving them, making it seem like they have larger populations than they do. And all of the while in making it so that these people, these 2 million people, don't have the opportunity to vote themselves and to participate in the electoral process.
There's so much in this. You know, when you talk about 99% of people having the same opinion about their own fate being ignored, it is par for the course often when we talk about community engagement and any other euphemism we use for pretending like we are listening to the most affected and then doing what we were going to do anyway. And this is a point that I make continuously to people when they talk about how social change works and what they can do, especially if they have any kind of decision-making power whatsoever, is to remind folks that people do not simply want to be heard. They want to have power in making decisions that will affect them. And so you can send out all of the surveys that you want. But if in the end you ignore a clear majority opinion on what people have decided for their own fate, then you are no better than the people who didn't send the survey at all, the people who didn't inquire at all. And so that is just really ringing in my head as I listen to you talk about this story, Clint. The other piece, you know, is that as you were talking and as I was reading this, it felt not unlike the three-fifths compromise, right? Where enslaved people were counted as three-fifths of a human being in order to increase population in southern states and districts to increase their political power in the federal government, in United States Congress. The powers that be have continued to ignore folks' humanity so that they can hoard their own political power. And every single time that we put power over people, we'll continue to have the same result.
And I think that's a really important point you made, Britt. Just real quick, the analog to the three-fifths compromise is like very real, and I'm wary of direct comparisons of like antebellum slavery to mass incarceration. But it's almost like in some cases, in some sense, it's worse, right? Because this is almost a five-fifths compromise, because you are we're no longer counting three-fifths of them toward the population of this place without electoral power. Now you are counting the entire person toward the population, and still they have no electoral power, right? So like it's almost in that context, it's almost more egregious than what folks were doing in 1860.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's wild. And I think, you know, a couple of things. One, you have, you know, the prison population is overwhelmingly people of color, but prisons tend to be built in rural, whiter communities. And so what you're essentially doing is transferring, you know, the political representation and political power of millions of people of color who are incarcerated from their communities and them right to, you know, the rural white communities in which they're being housed. The other thing that's interesting is that, you know, I recently learned that this is unique to prisons. So like, for example, people who are in boarding school who are, you know, essentially housed elsewhere away from their home for extended periods of time are not counted in this way by the census, but prisoners are counted this way, right? And so, you know, if you are wealthy and go to a wealthy boarding school, you do not sort of give up your political representation to the, you know, the community in which you are going to school. But if you are incarcerated, you do. And so there's hypocrisy in that. And I think the second piece that's important to note is that even though the census is not going to be doing this year, what is possible is to actually change some of this at the state level. And so there are a number of states like New York and California that manually adjust the census data for this. So they account for people's home addresses and they change, they sort of adjust the data in order to reflect people's home addresses instead of the addresses in which they're incarcerated. So this is something that can be changed at the state level while we continue to push, you know, the federal government to do things differently at a national level.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add is that my wonderful home state of Maryland and New York, where I used to live, passed legislation to end prison-based gerrymandering and count incarcerated people at home. So they did that, and New York's law was upheld by the New York State Supreme Court. Maryland's law was upheld by the Supreme Court of the United States. And like Sam said, Delaware and California actually passed this legislation to end prison-based gerrymandering starting with the 2020 census. So it can happen, and it is unfortunate that this Trump administration is not willing to engage this at the national level right now, but it is actually really possible for states and cities to really lead here. It's one of those things, too, that like people don't even think about, but in places like Baltimore, where the majority of people in prison are from cities, the city of Baltimore, or from other densely populated areas in the state, when you remove these people from the city rolls and put them in like the random small town where the prison's located, you are fundamentally changing what power looks like at the state level, and that's just not fair. So I'm proud to be from a state that that has fixed this, but there are so many other places across the country that need to do it.
So my piece of news is related to this. You know, we talked about prison-based gerrymandering and how that takes away and compromises the political power of folks who are incarcerated. We've also talked in previous episodes about disenfranchisement, in particular in Florida. And how, you know, according to the Sentencing Project, about 6 million people are prohibited from voting by law because of a felony conviction. So just to dive deeper in that, an article came out in truthout.org called Disenfranchised by Misinformation. Many Americans are allowed to vote but don't know it. And so this is another aspect of disenfranchisement that doesn't get talked about as much, and that is that people, even after their voting rights are technically reinstated, so in states that are not the four states that permanently ban people from voting with a felony conviction, so those are, you know, Iowa, Florida, Virginia, and Kentucky, every other state, at some point, you have your voting rights restored, almost always. Whether it is after you complete your sentence, sometimes even, you know, you never have your voting rights taken away in places like Vermont. But what they find in this article is that many people actually don't know that they've had their rights restored. And so, you know, many people believe that if you are convicted of a felony, then you actually never get your rights restored, even in states where that's not true. And so I did a little bit of digging deeper and looking at some of the research, and found a particular study that's called Studies of Voting Behavior and Felony Disenfranchisement Among Individuals in the Criminal Justice System. And they look at three states, New York, Connecticut, and Ohio, and they survey the population of people who are returning from prison. And, you know, these are states where once you've completed your sentence, you're no longer disenfranchised, you're technically eligible to vote. So they survey people who are released from prison. What they find is that 52% of those released from prison after completing their sentence believe, either they believe that they are permanently disenfranchised, or they simply don't know whether or not they're disenfranchised if they've ever been convicted of a felony. And another 31% of people believes if you have even ever been arrested, you are permanently not eligible to vote. And so this is actually really, really huge in regards to disenfranchisement, because more people are actually have their voting rights restored than are permanently disenfranchised, because there are only four states that permanently disenfranchise people. And yet, you know, you have 2.2 million people who are incarcerated, usually for like an average length of sentence for about 4 years. And after that, they return to community. So you have millions and millions of people. The estimate is about 19 million people in this country who have a felony conviction. And this research suggests that about half of them believe that they do not have the right to vote, even though technically they're eligible to vote. And so, you know, this, number one, what this means is that, you know, in terms of our advocacy and how we're talking about disenfranchisement, that it's important to not only be seeking to end the laws that legally disenfranchise people, but also to make sure that people know who are not currently disenfranchised, who've had their voting rights restored or are newly eligible to vote, that they too can vote. And this is so important because, you know, if you try to register to vote and you are technically supposed to be disenfranchised, then it's actually considered voter fraud. So people don't want to register to vote if they don't think that, if they think that they are still disenfranchised, because they will be breaking the law again. And so we have to be clear about when people are eligible to vote, engage in targeted outreach to make sure people know that they have that power to vote and that they can exercise it. Or else, in essence, what's happening is that there's a de facto disenfranchisement layered on top of the legal disenfranchisement that is just as pervasive and has just as large an impact on voting rights.
Part of what you're talking about, Sam, part of what it illuminates is that having the right to something does not necessarily correlate with having access to something. And part of it is that, you know, it's a set of very purposeful tactics on behalf of folks who want to keep people who are coming back from being incarcerated from voting, because they know that it represents a threat to their power. They know that it represents a threat to their electoral power, because these folks are disproportionately people who would be voting Democratic. They would be voting for candidates on the left. And part of what it reminds me of, you know, is that, like, you know, some people don't understand is that Black folks in this country had the right to vote in 1870 after the passage of the 15th Amendment. But just because Black people had the right to vote did not mean that there were not a range of egregious and insidious ways that people, specifically in the South, but not singularly the South, came up with, like, you know, poll taxes and counting jelly beans in a jar and reciting the Constitution by heart, and, you know, and all of these sort of like ways that were meant to specifically prevent people from having access to the polls that were technically not in violation of their right to vote.
And just to build off that point, Clint, about purposefully obfuscating that, you know, only half of states actually notify people when they have their voting rights restored. Like when they are eligible to vote, whether it's completing your sentence or what have you, only half of states actually have a law in place that requires them to notify people that they can vote. And among the states that actually do notify people, you know, those types of notifications vary. So in New York and North Carolina, once you are released from your sentence, you get this packet, which is a really dense packet with a bunch of papers in it. And on one of the papers, in the bottom right corner, is a paragraph that says you can vote. But, you know, again, a lot of people will not read that, will not see that. It is not made prominent. It is not, you know, a single thing that people receive that would make it easier to see. Many people may not be able to read at the level of the document. It's a pretty dense document. And so, you know, that's it. That's what you get. And if you miss that, you know, you are completely dependent on your own to, you know, find out what your rights are and how you can exercise them at tremendous penalty. You know, if you are wrong, you could go back to prison. And so, you know, the system is not at all set up for people to succeed. And when you look at the research, what's clear is that, you know, in places that make an intentional effort to notify people, like, for example, in Connecticut, there was an experiment that was done where they partnered with the Secretary of State's office to send a letter to people who were recently released from their sentence. And that letter said, you have your right to vote back. And they were able to increase turnout among, you know, formerly disenfranchised people by 25% to 30% just because they received that letter notifying them that they could vote. So these things really do matter to people's ability to participate in the political process. So not only do we need to change the law, but we also need to make an intentional effort to keep people informed about what the law is and what their rights are.
Don't go anywhere. More Politics the People's coming.
So we make an intentional effort on the pod to discuss news that is often going underreported or unnoticed. Often that brings into the forefront for us actions of this administration that are happening just under the surface, out of plain sight. And unfortunately, even after the valiant efforts of so many, especially people in the reproductive rights community and the disability rights community, all the work that they did to save ACA, the secretive, harmful workings of this administration still continue to extend to healthcare. And we discussed before how long it took for CHIP to actually receive its funding once again, even though CBO actually let Congress know that running the program would actually save the government money. And now the administration is messing with Medicaid. How are they doing that? They are creating certain hard limits and barriers to access for folks who receive this service. Now, as a reminder, Medicare is for elderly people in our community, and Medicaid is for folks currently living in low-income circumstances. So with Medicaid, you have to understand that it is a program that it runs in partnership between states and the federal government. What has always been allowed in the Medicaid process is the application by states for certain waivers so that they can be exempt from certain requirements at the federal level. Now, under previous administrations, including the Obama administration, all of those waivers had to come with some kind of guarantee of coverage expansion so that whatever they were exempting themselves from wouldn't come at the cost of the beneficiaries of Medicaid. That is not the case moving forward with this administration. So here are some of the waivers that have been created by states. There are states that are adding work requirements, which the Obama administration was very clear that they were not going to allow. So in places like Kentucky and Indiana, people have to show that they've worked a certain number of hours in order to receive their Medicaid benefits. So in places where work insecurity is already very high, you're now creating an additional barrier for people to get access to their benefits. There are also 9 states that have actually increased their premiums, which is fascinating given that the number one GOP argument against ACA surviving was that it was going to increase people's premiums. And so in places like Kentucky, that premium can be as as high as 4% of your income, which is just an astronomical price when you are thinking about potentially life-saving treatments and drugs that people need every day to survive. And so now that waiver applications don't have to include coverage expansion, we're seeing these high barriers come from states that were previously unable to get them through. And the sad news is, as far as states in this administration are concerned, this is just the beginning. There are states that are even looking at putting a lifetime cap or limit on just how many Medicaid benefits an individual can draw down. And so I wanted to call attention to this because as we have been rightfully celebrating the protection that many people have ensured came for the Affordable Care Act, there are ways that this administration and Republican governors all across the country are chipping away at people's healthcare benefits. And it, let's be very clear, this comes at the highest of costs because this is an issue of life or death for people.
And what's wild about this is that, you know, there's so little oversight in this whole process. It is oftentimes, you know, the governor's office partnering with, you know, the federal government and the Trump administration to make this happen without the state legislature signing off on it. You know, this is something that is able to happen with very little recourse because, you know, until we can actually put, you know, elect these governors out of office, which we need to do in November, you know, there is not much that Congress can do. There's not much that, you know, that state legislatures can do. And I think that's really why this is particularly pernicious, because this affects so many people. It fundamentally affects one of the largest, you know, healthcare programs in the country. And this is all being allowed to happen, you know, through administrative and executive actions.
Something that I always think about when I think about Medicaid, and that I've been reflecting on a lot over the last few months is the way that we think about and define poverty. It's interesting the way that we discuss the poverty line, like the quote unquote poverty line, as if it were this thing that kind of fell from the sky and was enshrined in stone and was like very clear, written by the founding fathers. But like it's important for people to remember that it is a largely arbitrary number that is not actually reflective of the economic conditions that people and the material conditions that people are experiencing, right? And that the federal poverty level does not change based on the state you live in or the city you live in, where clearly the cost of living in Kansas is like fundamentally different than the cost of living in New York City. And yet the federal poverty level is the exact same for all of those things. And I say that because to qualify for Medicaid, you have to have an income at or below 138% of the federal poverty level. And for an individual, the federal poverty level is $12,000.60. And so 138% of that is $15,856. And that was starting in 2014. And what's important to remember, like, is that if you make let's say you are an individual making $20,000, I would argue, and I think most people would agree, you are still living in poverty, considering like the cost of living in 2018 in most places, and yet you don't qualify for Medicaid. So you are ostensibly responsible for your own medical costs, and yet you live in like a deeply impoverished context. And I just think that that's really important for us to keep in mind and to sort of complicate and push the way that we're thinking about what poverty is or isn't, even how we're defining it, is that like the federal poverty line is a metric that actually fails to capture who is or is not living in poverty. And like someone who is, you know, making a few thousand dollars more than what the federal poverty line denotes as being impoverished is still a poor person.
I was mindful with this administration that they're playing the long game, and so I'm trying to figure out like what the long game is here. When we think about the sum effect of what happened with or what they're doing with immigration and all the work around the border and the Muslim ban, is that it is projected now that the sum total of that is going to keep the country to be a majority white country for at least 5 years longer than we had projected. You know, America was supposed to be a majority minority country in around 2042, and now it looks like it's going to be a little closer to 2050 because of what Trump has done so far. And with this, it's like, what is the long game of like denying people health care or making it harder for them to get access to health care. And it just sort of boggles my mind that there is either money to gain or that there's some benefit to restricting people's access, especially people who already can't afford so many other things, which are the people who qualify for Medicaid. And, you know, we said on a previous episode, but half the kids born in the country are actually born via Medicaid. So it's not an insignificant program. And you think about, you know, neonatal and prenatal care that is required for babies to be born healthy, that there'd be so many kids who would never see the light of day if their parents, like, didn't have access to health care. And so I'm trying to figure out, like, what the long game here is. And I can't think of anything that's just not pernicious and a complete disregard for people who aren't wealthy. My news is about Pennsylvania. So Pennsylvania, if you have not been following it, Pennsylvania submitted a district map for the upcoming elections, and it got turned down by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court as being gerrymandered, and it was appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and they denied the stay. So Pennsylvania has to redraw the congressional districts, which is a good thing for democracy. They actually just resubmitted new proposed districts that seem to be almost identical to the ones that were denied by the courts the first time. But what is more fascinating about this story is that there is a legislator in Pennsylvania who actually is trying to remove all of the justices on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court who said that the map was gerrymandered. And it's like this crazy thing. And, you know, I think about this because you see that there are rules in place, that there's supposed to be a system of checks and balances, that's supposed to be a bedrock of the way we've configured our democracy. And the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania said that this map was gerrymandered and wasn't fair. And what you find is a legislator pushing to get rid of all the judges on the court so that he can push through a map that makes no sense. And like, these are the things that you don't even realize have happened until you look up and you're like, wow, I didn't, you know, here we go. This is how we got to really crazy politics. But I wanted to bring it here because I was shocked when I read it. But it also made me more mindful that we got to, like, pay attention to even the things that we thought were going to be okay.
Yeah, this reminds me of what Mitch McConnell and the Republicans did with Gorsuch, right? They changed the composition of the Supreme Court, right? So we talk about gerrymandering in Pennsylvania. Like, luckily, this was a state Supreme Court decision, which is based on the state constitution in Pennsylvania. Otherwise, it would be more likely for the Supreme Court to you know, take this up. But for the other gerrymandering cases, which have an incredible bearing on congressional representation and democracy, you know, that's being decided now by a Supreme Court that is a Republican majority Supreme Court because they stole a justice, right? They stole a justice. They stole Obama's ability to appoint Merrick Garland and put in Gorsuch. And now we're seeing sort of the reverse happen with Republicans in Pennsylvania, where if the court is a different composition than they like already, then they'll just remove the justices they don't like. So, you know, that's the type of anti-democratic thinking that is increasingly becoming the norm in the Republican Party, and that's bad for democracy.
You know, I was reading about the founder of the Kaplan study method, Stanley Kaplan. Stanley Kaplan's intention was essentially to demystify the Scholastic Aptitude Test, the SAT, and other aptitude tests that were being specifically leveraged to keep Jewish people like Stanley Kaplan out of higher education. And when the folks running Ivy League schools were asked why they were using these this way, they essentially talked about Jewish people as being too hardworking and therefore embarrassing the students that were already there by their strong work ethic, which, like, is laden with, like, a bunch of stereotype threat, to be very clear. And, like, you know, stereotypes are harmful in lots of ways, even model quote unquote minority ones. So I want to be clear about that. But I was reading it and I was just astounded by the fact that they were essentially saying, We know that what we are doing is wrong, but we are doing it to protect our mediocrity and our way of life, right? And our way of life depends on the exclusion of other people. And that just, I was so reminded of that story as I was reading this piece of news, because corrupt power will stop at nothing to protect itself. When they gerrymandered this map, they knew exactly what they were doing. Folks worked on this together over a long period of time, to your point about the long game, DeRay. And when it was discovered to be as problematic as it absolutely is, the solution here is not to have a logical argument about why things were that way, because there is no logic behind it. It was about the protection of corrupt power. So instead, the solution is, let us just protect our way of life by getting rid of you. We've seen that theme come up over and over and over again in America. My hope is that the folks who would be engaged with so-called impeachment proceedings would be able to see right through this.
I've really just been reflecting, I think, on how skewed what we call our democracy actually is. And I think we know that for like a lot of different reasons, but like if you really just sit down and think about it, the fact that they are able to hold 13 of 18 congressional seats and that they did not win the majority of the votes, like that should be that should outrage everyone. The same way that like presidential candidates who win the popular vote are not winning the elections. And I think that it is, I even struggle to like call ourselves a democracy in the way that it is like in with regard to what the word is actually supposed to mean. And I think to Brittany's point, the Republican Party recognizes, and Brandon Terry talked about this a little bit last week on the podcast, the Republican Party recognizes that they are existing in like under existential threat because of the demographic shifts of this country. So they are going to continue to bend every rule, break every rule, turn everything over, do whatever they have to do in order to maintain power. And like what we've seen over the last year of Trump in power is that like people's principles are secondary to them maintaining and expanding their power.
Clint, that's wild. And I think it shows up in every sort of layer of the system, right? It's not just the Electoral College. It's the fact that that's built on, you know, a model of Senate representation that, you know, allows states that have very small populations to exercise so much control over everybody else, and that strips DC of any Senate representation, which is layered on top of Congress, which is gerrymandered such that, like, we can expect in 2018, like in this November, that Democrats will need to win by more than 6% of the margin, the popular vote margin, in order to win the majority of House seats. Like, that's just a expectation that I guess we've had to come to accept as like the only scientific way to win enough majorities in enough of these gerrymandered districts in order to retain a majority of the House that we deserve if we can win, you know, 50 plus one, right? And I think that's just, you know, and then you look at the state level, what's happening in Pennsylvania, you look at what happens in so many places, even at the local level, where you have city councils that are gerrymandered in a way where I think of Baton Rouge, where it's a majority Black jurisdiction, but it has a majority white council representation because of how they've gerrymandered their city council districts. So this is happening at every level, and it is something that is going to take a very broad and determined and longstanding effort in order to overturn.
That's the news. And now my conversation with Tanana Reeve-Du and Stephen Barnes about Afrofuturism and the upcoming movie Black Panther. Thanks so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People. Excited to have you both here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Now, both of you study Afrofuturism and representations of Black people, and you've contributed to this field in so many ways. Can you help the people who don't know this work well just understand a little bit more about your background?
Sure. T, why don't you go first?
Sure. My name is Tanana Reeve-Du. I am an author and a screenwriter. I teach Afrofuturism and Black horror at UCLA, as well as private courses. And I'm probably best known for my novels, My Soul to Keep, about Ethiopian immortals, The Living Blood. I write little science fiction. I write horror. So I've been swimming in these waters since about 1995.
Hi, my name is Steve Barnes, and I've been an Afrofuturist novelist for about 30 years at this point. And I guess the books I'm most known for are alternate histories like Lion's Blood, or futuristic novels like Street Lethal and Gorgon Child, things of that nature. So I've also written for television, Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, Stargate, and Andromeda, and things like that. So I've been around for a while.
And what is Afrofuturism? I ask because Black Panther's coming out, and in so many ways this world will be bandied about in popular culture in ways that I'm not sure it's been in a while or ever. How would you describe Afrofuturism to people who either have had no exposure to it or don't think they've had exposure to it?
That's a great question, and it's not always an easy question to answer because Afrofuturism means slightly different things to different people. I think a lot of people hear the term Afrofuturism and they just think, okay, Black folks in the future, Black futurity, and that is part of it. But really, it's more of a movement. And I tweeted the other day, I would call it like throughout the diaspora. So it's not African American. Throughout the diaspora, it's an artistic, cultural, and social movement invoking a reimagining of race, racial constructs, history, like Steve's novel Lion's Blood is an alternate history, and liberation themes through what we call speculative, a speculative lens. Speculative means it's myth, fantasy, science fiction, horror, in music. It's using technology to change the sound and to move music forward. So it really involves tech, music, literature. But the shortest definition is a reimagining of a Black future and past.
You know, I think that Afrofuturism, from my point of view as a novelist, is a subset of science fiction. Science fiction is basically fantasy that is anchored to what we understand of the sciences. So it involves technology, it involves interactions with technology, discovery, things of that nature. Afrofuturism would be this literature applied specifically to the children of the diaspora, either about them or from their perspective. So it's If you look at science fiction as a way of looking at the world and creating new myths, new understandings of where we fit in the universe, then Afrofuturism would be specifically where do Black people fit in the universe? And I think that would cover a lot of my own perspectives on it.
Now, why does this matter? Like, what makes Afrofuturism important in the spectrum of genres? And why does a movie like Black Panther matter in a moment like this, besides just having Black people in film? And what does it do to the way that we think about stories themselves?
Well, representation, especially fantastic representation, really helps us see ourselves in a broader mirror. You know, so many of us, especially as African Americans, have lived under these sort of constraints of how we can even dream. So in early cinema, we were the maids and housekeepers and servants and comic relief. In genre, like horror, we were the first to die, the sacrificial Negro. So imagine, you know, being a kid in the 1960s, seeing someone like Nichelle Nichols on Star Trek as a little Black girl or even a Black boy and realizing, oh, hold up, we're in the future, we're on the deck of the ship. And it just is such an empowering thought that you can help create a future where you've been so absent. And we've had little dribs and drabs across the years, but there's never been a cinematic spectacle like Black Panther that so firmly establishes this kind of visual mythology of power, technological prowess, courage, family, community. It's just it's a really important nutrient for the growth of Black folks.
I think that every culture in the world has mythologies that connect them to the origin of the universe and says things about where they're going to be heading in the future. Black Americans had their mythologies, their languages, their names, their cultures all stripped away from them. And what happened is that white people replaced those with the mythologies that made them central in our universe. You can't thrive that way. You know, every group of people has the right to consider themselves to be, you know, healthfully superior. That is just the way human beings are. So Afrofuturism or science fiction was a way of connecting Northern Europeans largely to the center of the universe. So Afrofuturism is simply allowing us to place ourselves as central actors and movers and shakers in the way we see our existence, rooting us in the past, opening the door to our future. It's critical. I think that mythology is not dessert. It's meat and potatoes. It's part of the way that our consciousness organizes itself. You have to believe that you can do something before you'll even try to do it. And if you don't try, you never can.
Are there any misconceptions about the genre of Afrofuturism that we should name?
You know, misconceptions. One of the things that I've noticed is that for people in circles who don't quite get the excitement about Black Panther, let's say they're non-Black folks or non-Marvel fans, or, you know, over to the racist side where they're sort of actively hostile toward Black Panther, as if it's something dangerous, as if it's something against white people, or to go to the other side of, say, super woke Black folks who look at it as sort of misplaced excitement. Like, why does a movie matter? We know it's not going to pay the rent. We know it's not going to solve income disparities and make our schools better. We get that. We still have our bills waiting for us the day after we see Black Panther. But what it will do is electrify us as adults, even. You know, the 30-second line of dialogue in Captain America: Civil War, where the member of the Dora Milaje said, "Move or be moved." Black women lost their minds over like one line of dialogue. because it's power. And we can't even calculate the impact it will have on children. You know, I'm just thinking about adults and how powerful it makes me feel. I feel like I'm in a spaceship in my car when I think about Black Panther. But for children, we're planting seeds that are going to sprout in ways we can't even predict. So no, it's not going to solve things immediately. But what it can do is literally help change the world.
I think that if you ask, how do people accomplish something? They have to have an idea of what they want to do, and they have to believe that they can do it. They have to believe that accomplishing it will bring them more pleasure than pain. If they don't believe that, they won't try. So in life, often things can be so harsh that it's like we can't see the forest for the trees. Our noses are right up against the tree, so we can't see the overall pattern of what's going on. You know, all we can see is the deprivation. We can't see how far we've come, and we can't see how beautiful the future can be. I think that by creating images like this, the cultural impact feels to me like Star Wars times Roots. We've never had anything like this before, and what you're seeing when people are buying out theaters and raising money to send entire schools to go see it is a hunger for the kinds of imagery that white people have given their children 24/7, you know, since the beginning of our country. You know, that they are great, that they're wonderful, that God loves them best, that they can accomplish anything. That is what children need to hear. And that's what we all need to feel about ourselves. And we've, you know, slavery in many ways was the process of turning wolves into dogs, domesticating human beings, taking away their agency, their dreams, and making them believe that they are dependent upon the person who puts the kibble on the floor. When you start waking up from that, when you start becoming an adult in the particular sense of understanding that you have the right to protect and raise your children, that you have all the rights anyone else has, when once you open your eyes to that, you become dangerous. So it's not an accident that it's taken so long to get something like this on the screen. And it's not an accident that people are responding to it so powerfully.
But I will say that throughout a lot of traditional science fiction and horror, you do have negative images of Black folks, you know, that we're not only underrepresented, but when we have been represented, it has been in very negative ways, sort of servants and sacrifices, coonishly as coons, certainly in cinema. So there is that history that we're trying to break away from within genre, because a lot of Black readers and movie viewers will say, well, I don't like science fiction, or I don't like horror, I don't like comics, because guess what? Either they weren't represented or they weren't represented well.
Well, and the lack of representation can be pretty brutal. I mean, if you have a movie like when worlds collide, where the Earth is going to be destroyed and you're only going to save, you know, 100, 150 human beings, and every single human being who's being saved is white. And you watch that as a child, the message is very clear. You don't matter.
There's no room for you now, and there's no room for you in the future. It's devastating. There were no black people in the original Star Wars, you know? So there have been strides to change that. But what does that say? I mean, I loved Star Wars as a kid. I honestly didn't notice consciously that there weren't any black folks in that movie. But when you get older, you start to wonder why you're absent and what that means.
Well, also, when you have a movie like Black Panther and you hear white people saying, well, why aren't there more white people in it? You know, the thought is, well, what are you saying about Star Wars, about Lord of the Rings, about most of the Marvel movies?
And everything.
You know, about everything. What you're saying is that we should have taken that as an insult, that all along we should have been offended when all along they were telling us, oh, it doesn't matter. It obviously does matter. And it matters a lot. Every group of people tells their children that they are precious and spins stories of their ancestors and their descendants to create a context. This is what life is. This is what your potential is. This is what the future can be. And when you're cut off from that, when someone strips away those stories, those cultural stories, it's basically like wiping your hard drive. And what they do is they get to implant Slave 1.0, and they will tell you who you are. And inevitably, if you let someone else control your mythologies, they will always make it disadvantageous to you.
And control your future.
Yeah, they're going to try to control you. They're going to make up your identity to benefit them.
Now, what should people know or think about heading into seeing Black Panther?
Well, I could tell you I've seen Black Panther. I was really, really privileged to go to the Hollywood premiere with a reporter for Entertainment Weekly. I'll have to shout him out. Anthony Bresnahan, thank you for that ticket. And of course, like any moviegoer, I was afraid that my hopes had been driven too high, that all the best moments would be in the trailer. I've been burned that way before, and that it would somehow be a massive disappointment. You know, I was just afraid because I wanted to succeed so much. And none of that was true. It was everything I thought. So if people who have seen even just the initial trailer, I don't even advise people to watch more trailers before they see it. The initial trailer shows you everything you need to understand about this movie, the strength of it, the beauty of it, the singularity of it, it's all there. So even if you've never read a Black Panther comic, even if you've never seen another Marvel movie, it doesn't matter. Black Panther is a standalone. That's why the critics are saying it's unlike, I think, any other Marvel movie. It has its own look and feel, and it is a standalone story.
And what about the universe? Where does Wakanda sit in terms of the Marvel universe?
Wakanda was originally created in 1966 by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, the fathers of the Marvel Universe, the godfathers or the grandfathers of the Marvel Universe. And it was created specifically because Kirby and Lee saw that there were no black superheroes of any consequence. So they did it very deliberately. And he was created to be the smartest, richest, and one of the toughest human beings on the planet. Wakanda is a mythical African kingdom that was never conquered by Europeans, that is sitting on top of the world's greatest natural resource, a metal called vibranium. And that metal enabled them to develop separately from the rest of the world an incredibly advanced world, an advanced kingdom that is hidden. The rest of the world does not know very much about Wakanda at all.
And get this, Captain America's shield, that oh-so-powerful shield by iconic Captain America, is actually made out of vibranium. So it's almost like a secret society that is helping to power other superheroes.
So Wakanda is a repository of wealth and knowledge, you know, super science. Black Panther himself, over the course of, you know, five decades of stories about him, has manifested as one of the smartest, toughest, most savvy, most strategic thinkers in the entire Marvel universe. And Wakanda is one of the gems in Marvel's crown. It really is.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about Afrofuturism and the movie. Is there anything else that should be on people's minds as we wade into what will surely be a celebration of both Blackness and the genre of Afrofuturism?
Well, I think one thing people want to bear in mind, as someone who teaches Afrofuturism, I've noticed that a lot of the students who are drawn to speculative fiction are world builders in real life. There tends to be a bit of an activist bent to especially Black creatives who are exposed to this sort of wider tableau. It's like, oh, I don't just have to tell history. I don't just have to tell survival stories, although those are very important, but I can expand my vision and my universe. People have even used work like Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower to create real life community building. So I hope, and I know, in fact, that after the lights come up and people are leaving the theater, they're going to be fueled by that power of Afrofuturism to say, hey, that was fun, but what can I do now to create a real different future?
Perfect. Well, thanks so much. Consider you both friends of the pod and can't wait to see you back on the pod. And, you know, I can't wait to see the movie.
Great.
Great. Fantastic. Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks so much for listening to Pod Save the People. Make sure you tell a friend, and I will see you back here next week.